This is episode 49 of Write with Impact. My guest today is Brian Clark, founder of Copyblogger and CEO of Rainmaker Digital.
If you can write, if you can create content, you can create intellectual property, which means you can create products that make you a lot of money.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Write with Impact. I'm Glenn Leibowitz. I'm a writer who wants to help you become a better writer and build your audience. I'm very pleased to introduce my guest today, Brian Clark. Brian is a legendary figure in the content marketing space. He's the founder of Copyblogger, the world's most widely followed website on all things content marketing. He's also the CEO of Rainmaker Digital, the company he formed through the merger of several successful companies he had built over the years. Their Rainmaker platform is an integrated content management system that digital entrepreneurs can use to build their businesses without having to worry about getting their hands dirty with code and other technical aspects of building and maintaining a website. Brian also hosts Unemployable, a podcast where he interviews freelancers and digital entrepreneurs who share their stories and strategies for building profitable businesses while doing what they love. In our conversation, Brian shares the story of how he quit a lucrative but unsatisfying career in law to strike out on his own as an entrepreneur, first serving the real estate industry and later setting up Copyblogger and eventually Rainmaker Digital, which today is a $12 million business that helps content creators and digital marketers around the world. Brian also shares insights from his experience as a successful entrepreneur and has advice for writers and other content creators. You can find links to Brian's websites in the show notes to this episode over at writewithimpact.com/episode49. While you're there, be sure to pick up a free ebook with some of my writing tips and join my newsletter so you're the first to know when I publish a new episode of this podcast or a new article about writing. You can also find my articles on Inc. over at writewithimpact.com/Inc. That's INC. Okay, here's Brian Clark. So Brian, thanks a lot for joining the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'd like to talk to you about a couple things. First of all, if you could just tell us a little bit about your story. You know, I've been following you for a number of years, through Copyblogger and now Rainmaker Digital, and you've got a fascinating story. So I'd like you to share that first, and then maybe a little bit later we could talk about, my audience is writers and content creators. What can they do to sort of turn their skill into something a little bit bigger and better? You know, how can they, for lack of a better word, maybe monetize their skill, turn writing into a product that they can sell? And also, how do they build their audience? I'm wondering if that's something that we could cover today.
Absolutely. So let me give you as succinct a summary of 18 years as I can. I basically graduated from law school in 1994. I knew then I didn't want to practice law, but I did it for 4 years. Had a big law firm job, nice salary, everything except I hated it. And meanwhile, from 1994 to 1998, I'm looking at this new thing called the World Wide Web. And I'm kind of fascinated and a little obsessed about when you can reach, theoretically, everyone on the planet, there should be a way that you could make a living from that. And like a lot of frustrated attorneys, I wanted to be a writer, but I also have, I guess you probably know why my podcast is called Unemployable. I didn't know it then, but I not only didn't like practicing law, I didn't like working for other people. So I didn't have a good attitude towards New York publishing. I really didn't have a good idea or attitude towards Hollywood, even though, you know, screenwriting was something that I found interesting. That ecosystem I thought would just be horrible. And so I turn back in 1998, and I'm just fed up. And I end up leaving my job. I'm living in Austin, Texas at the time. And I figure, if I have to be a bartender in Austin for the rest of my life, I guess there are worse things, you know. But I was going to make a go of it. So back at that time, before blogs, people were publishing email newsletters or e-zines. And I was observing from the outside in. And back then, we didn't have all these tell-all blogs and conferences and courses and all that. You just basically had to make relationships and observe what other people were doing and then try to figure it out yourself. So I started publishing my own e-zines because that satisfied my need to write. And yet I was able to, you know, I didn't have to ask anyone's permission. I just got to do it. And the business model at the time, as with historically all content, really kind of, at least in a media perspective, was advertising. And that was a hard thing. I mean, it's always been a hard thing. You have to have massive amounts of traffic and audience in order to make that economically viable. Plus, added to the fact that back then in 98, 99, you know, we didn't even have the online ad industry that we have today. So it wasn't until 1999, you know, I went into this, I could write, I succeeded at building audiences. I got press, I got written up in, you know, magazines and newspapers, all this stuff. But what I didn't do was make any money really of any substance. And then so in 1999, a book called Permission Marketing came out by Seth Godin. And Seth was an old school kind of direct marketing guy who migrated to the internet, and he automatically understood what was the same and what was different. He considered the internet a direct marketing medium in the sense that you don't have to have intermediaries. You can have a direct relationship with your prospects and your customers and all that. And that was the first marketing book I had ever read. I was a liberal arts major who went to law school, never took a business class. So I was as green as possible, but I was also unsullied by any traditional concepts of marketing. So when Godin's book made a lot of sense to me, and I'm like, oh, I get it. I'm doing everything right, except instead of trying to sell advertising, I need to sell stuff or services. And the only thing I could have, you know, that I had at that time to sell, I still had a law degree. And I didn't want to be a bartender in Austin. So I bit the bullet and, you know, created a legal e-zine. You know, so this was a little more serious than the content that I was publishing before. It was about internet issues or legal issues related to the internet, I should say. And it was amazing because I'm only 5 years out of law school. I'm not a senior attorney type. And yet I was getting business left and right because the senior guys didn't understand the internet. And they certainly wouldn't think of sharing content for free online. And so nowadays we call that content marketing. But I didn't call it that at the time. I just was amazed that I could write things, be helpful, be informative. And then people would say, oh, I want to pay you thousands of dollars. And so I think it was that moment, even though I still didn't really like practicing law, I loved the idea that I could do something that was kind of the holy grail of attorneys, was to develop business. Those were the powerful attorneys. Those are called rainmakers. So you may see where a certain brand came from, right? And so from there, you know, basically fast forward a little bit, the dot-com crash happens. That kills the first business completely, which I was still trying to make a go of. And that was a great thing, actually, because I was like, no more of this. I understand how to do marketing and sell professional services. So I'm like, what's the next thing I can go into that's a little more entrepreneurial, where it's not me being the solo service provider? So I looked around, and at that time, 2001 was the beginning of IDX, which is a technology that is very common now. It allows people to display MLS real estate listings on websites. And this was a brand new thing at the time. I was living in Dallas, and Dallas happened to be one of the initial cities that rolled out this technology. And, you know, there was all this debate about among the traditional realtors, and most of them were ignoring it and thought the internet was a fad. But of course, I knew better than that. And so I totally embraced it. And, you know, no money, no investors, really, just a strung together collection of websites, which it was really a lot harder to do than it is these days. But I put it together, and, you know, I understood how to do pay-per-click advertising. I understood landing pages. I understood the importance of getting people on an email list. All of this is 2001. So the average broker or real estate agent, they didn't know any of this stuff. And surprisingly, they're still bad at it today, which I don't understand. But it was like shooting fish in the barrel. So through 2001 to 2005, I started two brokerages. We did residential. We did apartment complexes. I partnered with other brokers. We had agents. And it was very successful. And that was kind of my validation. I had no real passion for real estate. You know, I think early on in a lot of entrepreneurial careers, you want to succeed. You want to prove something to yourself and to the world. But I was really good at marketing, terrible at management. And through my own, you know, in the subsequent decade, I hear the same story from almost every other entrepreneur out there, which is, yeah, I went through that phase too. I didn't know how to delegate. I was stuck in the business. I couldn't work on it, blah, blah, blah. It's a common story. So by 2005, I was burnt out and had a near-death experience after a skiing accident, had to have brain surgery. And when I woke up from surgery, it was like a moment of zen. I was like, no more. I will never do anything just for money or to prove anything to anyone. So I kind of walked away from that business, tried to sell it to my partners, but it failed without me. And that's a valuable lesson because, again, they couldn't do the marketing. I didn't delegate a lot of key tasks, and it just all fell apart. So the bad thing about that is they couldn't pay me on installments for the business. So I essentially got nothing out of it. So I scrambled around again. When you know how to sell online, you can always make money, right? And of course, I had become a really fairly experienced copywriter because back in 99, when I understood that this was a new form of direct marketing, then that leads you naturally to direct response copywriting and all this stuff that has been historically offline. But, you know, I understood how to apply it online. It's a different context. So, you know, basically, coming into the end of 2005, I'm like, what am I going to do next? And I was kind of fascinated with the world of blogging at that time. Believe it or not, though, that's the year podcasting started, and I almost wanted to start a podcast. I would have been so too early for that, while also ignoring my main skill set of writing. So I think I made the right decision there. But so the idea was, you know, the world of commercial blogging was really just getting started. It was still a little kumbaya, but people were interested, you know, people who could write, some people who couldn't write that well, but wanted to do this blogging thing and make money. And of course, they're all trying to do advertising, right? That's the only business model, just like me in 98. So I come along with this blog, Copy Blogger, which had two goals. Number one, it's about applying copywriting techniques to content to make it more engaging, make it more readable, to attract more attention, more traffic, all that. The other aspect of it was what we now call content marketing, which means you don't sell advertising necessarily. You sell goods and services. And, you know, some of the early bloggers really took offense at that. But their audiences, like I would have people that would in 2006 just say, oh, this guy, he's got it all wrong. He doesn't know anything. But their audiences disagreed. So they're technically, you know, saying bad things about me, you know, in their opinion. But their audience was like, I don't know. That sounds interesting to me. So everyone who linked to me, whether good or bad, was the catalyst at that time for the audience growing really fast.
And then how did you turn the, you know, what were your first products, you know, from your blog? And was it Copy Blogger at the time? Is that what you started off with around then?
Yeah, no. So Copy Blogger was the first thing. It was what built the audience. But for, I think it was close to 18 months, I didn't have a product. First of all, because I didn't know what the right product would be yet. I was going to learn that from the audience. And the other thing was, because there was a little bit of, you know, hesitancy around the topics I was talking about, I wanted to go out of my way to build trust, you know, above and beyond. You would never have to do that today. In fact, some might argue that this whole content world is over-commercialized. But so going back to my own kind of epiphanies, the first thing I was trying to do was to turn writers, bloggers at the time, into entrepreneurs. And because that's the discovery I made about myself, I made the mistake of thinking that would be an easy thing to do. But not all writers want to be entrepreneurs, right? But in my opinion, writers are so fundamentally important. My favorite people in the world, and there have been lots that I've been able to watch, you know, with copy bloggers help start businesses and create products and all this great stuff. So that's awesome. But there is some resistance, I think, the mix of the writer's kind of craft and business. And I don't see a separation. I think it's vital to business, but, you know, you can only do what you can do. But our first product ended up being, you know, that same message. If you can write, if you can create content, you can create intellectual property, which means you can create products that make you a lot of money. So that was our first product. It was a training program to teach people how to create this exceptional kind of instructional designed, you know, powered premium content, what is now known as e-learning or online education. And the funny thing about that, here's again the difference between, you know, what 9 or 10 years can make. At that time, I had to convince people that people would pay for education, for online education, because those same crazy bloggers were saying no one's ever going to pay for information again. Now, I think e-learning was $23 billion in the U.S. alone. So again, these things are kind of obvious, I think, if you're coming from a certain perspective. But sometimes I think people get too caught up in these social media pundits who really never done anything except build an audience on social media. You know what I'm saying? So
they got a lot of Twitter followers, but you know, you don't really know where they came from.
Exactly. So and then the next year after that, it's interesting because I really admired a company called 37 Signals. They're now called Basecamp, but they were a design shop with a popular blog, started an audience, and then became software developers. And I'm like, wow, that is so cool. It's too bad I couldn't do that. But that's exactly what I ended up doing. So I love, because I can teach, you know, there's a business person that may be, you know, savvy and cutthroat, but I can't teach them to write well. But I can take any writer, I think, and teach them the necessary business skills without them ever having to sell their souls or anything ugly. Just, it's about providing value to people, and you have the means of doing it, which I think is cool.
Right. Well, that's an incredibly inspiring story. Before we go into sort of a little bit of the, if I pick your brain, a little bit of the how-to, if you just sort of, you know, finish your story and bring us up to date over the past, you know, a couple of years ago with the launch of Rainmaker Digital, because you just mentioned just very quickly in passing that, you know, you said you couldn't, you know, build a, you know, a software business, but that's exactly what you've done. You built a SaaS or software as a service business around this thing called Rainmaker Digital, which is doing very, very well. So just tell us a little bit about that. What is, you know, why did you decide to launch that? How did the launch go? What exactly is it? Who's it for? It sounds like it's exactly for the writers, you know, turn who, that you're trying to develop into entrepreneurs, and then we can, you know, move on.
Yeah. So Rainmaker Digital is actually the name of our company. We did about $12 million in revenue last year. We have 65 people, and they work virtually all around the world, which is another interesting thing about us. The SaaS is Rainmaker Platform. But let me backtrack how we got here, because that's kind of interesting as well. The important thing to know is that we're a completely bootstrapped company. We never took investment, and we didn't start advertising until this year. So that initial audience, which continued to aggressively grow, you know, through the subsequent years, is really what powers this company. So when people talk about content marketing and all this stuff, it is not, I mean, there are several, you know, startups, bootstrap companies that have the same story as us because of the audience that they built. So that's an important validation that this is not smoke and mirrors. But okay, so in 2008, like I said, we created a design framework for WordPress. At the time, everything for WordPress was free. And there were just a small group of us who decided to create a premium paid supported which is the key word, because in an open source environment, people are really paying you for support, because you don't get that with free themes and plugins. So that was our first, and when I say us, that was me and a partner, okay? The course that we created in 2007 was me and another partner. In 2009, I partnered yet again. This is my fourth company that's basically launched off of Copyblogger. And this was our first SaaS, which was called Scribe, which was it started as a very simple SEO copywriting software program that evolved into a more sophisticated content marketing SaaS, which is, it's been patent pending for a couple of years. If you know anything about patents, it takes a long time, but it looks like it's about to get its patent in a couple of months. So
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, that is just a component of what we were ultimately trying to build. But so I had these four companies, and I was the only thing in common. It was like these partners had no motivation to talk to one another because they had no economic interest in the other companies. So in 2010, I basically left one company over personality and philosophical disputes. Brian Gardner from Studio Press, which is another WordPress design company, stepped in, and we all convened together in Denver. And the goal was, let's merge all the companies together, join forces, and build this thing bigger than us. And that ultimately became the Rainmaker platform. But again, as a bootstrap company, we built the parts and sold the parts along the way. So we created our own landing page and membership software and sold that. We started our own WordPress hosting division called Synthesis and sold that. Just step by step by step, until finally in 2014, we had version 1.0 of the Rainmaker platform. And sitting here today, 2 years later, we just added the final piece of this total online platform, this integrated solution. And that last piece has been email. And so, yeah, what you said earlier is kind of correct. It's for people who can create content, who can do marketing, who can do the stuff that's necessary online, but they're not technical people. And the interesting thing about that is I'm our best, you know, customer case study, because I was able to play a really meaningful, and I always did play a meaningful role in software development, because I want to be able to do this without your help. How do we do that? And that's really how it works. And it's challenging, because if you want to do something that's very powerful, like Rainmaker platform is, and yet still make it easy enough to do, that's a tricky thing from an interface and a functionality thing. And we're constantly trying to refine that. I use the platform for two of my personal projects, because it's important for the CEO to use the technology. But it's funny how rare that is, right?
Right. So just a couple of minutes ago, Brian, you said something, you know, you built these things and then you sold them. But I, just to clarify, you didn't sell them sort of as a company, as an entity. You sold as a product, right? So you created a, you know, functionality that you used that was useful to you and your company, and you sold it as a product, but you still own it.
Yeah. No, we didn't sell off the assets. What I mean is, so for example, we had to get hosting infrastructure down cold at a really high level. So what we did was develop hosting. We always battled with our host. It was a nightmare for years. So I said, okay, first thing we're going to do, we get a ton of traffic, you know, compared to most websites. So we're going to host ourselves. And then once we get that to our liking and to our very demanding specifications, then we're going to launch it to the public. And, you know, Synthesis was never the end goal, but I think it still makes about $3 million a year, because it's really good hosting, you know. But we were creating that really good hosting for the thing we were ultimately trying to build, which is the Rainmaker platform, if that makes sense. So, you know, if you were a venture-funded startup, you would get a bunch of cash and you would just build the thing. but we didn't want to take on investors because, you know, freedom is nice too. You know, it's not always about making the most amount of money or whatever if you're miserable in the process. So yeah, when I say we built the parts, all the major initial components of Rainmaker were sold as individual lines of business. So we have Studio Press, we had Scribe, but we sunsetted that, and then we had Synthesis. Those were three crucial components. And then once we launched Rainmaker in 2014, we started improving from within and adding features and marketing automation and email and landing page builders and all those kind of great stuff that you need. Our podcast network is run on Rainmaker, so you can do that. It's not we don't make ours custom, right? It's Rainmaker out of the box, and we run an entire podcast network off of it. And that was good timing, given the podcasting boom that we saw about that same time.
No, exactly. About I think you launched in March of last year, 2015. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, a few months earlier, I wrote a blog post on LinkedIn that said why 2015 will be the year of the podcast. I published that on December 31st, 2014, and it was featured on LinkedIn. But, you know, I don't know why what I saw coming. I guess I was just reading and hearing a lot about podcasting, I thought.
Well, Serial, right?
Yeah, exactly. That really brought it to the fore, right?
It became a non-geeky thing. I mean, podcasting really started to grow thanks to a lot of the big comedians that are still big now, Joe Rogan, Mark Maron, stuff like that. I think that was the first. I mean, there was a lot of the geeky tech crowd who was also into that comedy, but that helped bring in some mainstream people. But Serial really busted it out because now just like your mom or might talk about Serial or something. You're like, wait, what a minute. You don't even know what a podcast is.
It's a portable mobile radio. It's radio on demand. But anyway, yeah, exactly. But you really, when you launched, I mean, you really launched. You didn't just launch one podcast or two. You launched a whole network right from the get-go. And, you know, I subscribe to most of them, I think, and I'm really enjoying yours, Unemployable. And so, you know, how's that been? It's been just barely, you know, a year. And, you know, you as sort of the content marketing expert, you know, if you're looking back, was that the right thing to do? And are you going to continue to just sort of, you know, double down on that?
Yeah, it was definitely the right thing to do. I think we learned a valuable lesson that more shows is not the answer. And we kind of let a Darwinian thing work itself out, and the shows that made it are still around, and the shows that didn't aren't. But the thing we learned from that is you have to really build each podcast brand. We truly were thinking of the network brand because as content marketers, we're not so concerned with getting sponsorships, although we're getting lots of inquiries about that. You know, this was just another content channel. We had this huge text audience, mainly of writers, and writers tend to read, right? But if you look at the statistics, most people don't read, like at all, like maybe one book a year, right? And yet that's why I think podcasting has really, once the mainstream caught onto it, they're like, oh yeah, I'll listen, and I don't even have to look at a screen. I could be jogging, I could be driving, I could be on the train, whatever. So to us, we're fans of podcasting. Okay. But to us, it's like, okay, we have this fairly big audience. I don't know. It's like 450, 500,000 people for the copy blogger. Okay.
You mean that's your email list. Is that how you measure your audience?
Well, the email is 350 and then there's RSS and I don't know those exact numbers. So I'm giving you a range, but you know, it's a good chunk of people. But we're not reaching, you know, we still don't do video, and that's the biggest one of all. So eventually you'll see us do that. I'm more cautious about that. Video is, you know, it's a whole different game when it's not just the words and it's not just the audio, it's the whole thing. And you want your production values to be good so you don't embarrass yourself. That doesn't stop a lot of people from embarrassing themselves, by the way. We just don't want to be those people. But yeah, audio was the next logical step for us because we're passionate about it. And that's just a whole bunch of people that we can talk to that wouldn't listen to us otherwise.
No, exactly. And I love your podcast. Has that been feeding your business? I mean, you know, almost every one of your podcasts on the network does have a little nice, you know, plug for the Rainmaker platform. I like that, you know, deep resonant voice of, you know, the guy who reads that off. But
that's Robert Bruce. He does have the golden pipes. Yeah. So the original, it doesn't, you know, we wanted to do it. It's not that much money, really. I mean, we have, you know, a production team and an outside editor that works closely with us. But for a company that's into the eight figures, it's not like we're bleeding cash with it. And the thing that always makes it justifiable is that this is just another demonstration of the Rainmaker platform when you look at it that way. So it's a justifiable marketing expense just for that. The thing is, though, we are seeing that we're connecting with new people and growing our overall audience. And again, to the point where we've got brands coming to us going, how much does it cost to sponsor a show? And we're like, you can't. And they're like, what do you mean I can't? So we're considering it, but it would have to be a balance. You know, I mean, our first and foremost goal is our own products and services. But if we can find a happy medium between the two, I think podcasting for us and then for everyone in general, and the Rainmaker, Rainmaker FM specifically, is a long game. I think we're still early. You know, people will say, well, if I only started in 2012, like Pat Flynn, it's still early. Trust me, you got to want it and you got to be tenacious.
No, exactly. I totally agree. I don't know if I'm sure you've seen that the research that Edison Research Group publishes.
Yeah, Tom Webster is a great guy. We actually had Edison audit the way we count our download stats, just so it was totally on the up and up. And if we ever did take sponsors, then they'd know that we weren't screwing around. But that also helps the platform because a lot of people do use it for podcasting. It's got, you know, included podcast storage, which, you know, saves you money from Libsyn right there. But yeah, we wanted to make sure we were doing it correctly. And Edison is the go-to, as you know.
Yeah. And, you know, the numbers that they show are really quite shocking. When I actually, you know, wrote the blog post on LinkedIn a year and a half ago, and I dug into their numbers, I was shocked, because basically what they're saying was, I think they call it share of ear. They're saying that, you know, I mean, they crunched the numbers and they do surveys, and basically, you know, the percentage of people that actually listen to podcasts is, out of the whole pie of potential, you know, audio listeners is actually still incredibly low.
It is. Terrestrial radio still rules, because look, we've got an exceedingly aging population, at least here in the States. And they're not going to switch over from what they're used to. And why should they? But that's what I'm saying. We've got the baby boomers were the largest generation, and they're all retiring and moving on to do whatever. Not to say that they won't discover podcasting, because it's built into cars now. You know, it's like the turnover. That was one of the stats. The turnover of new cars, right, was driving podcast adoption, because it's a feature in all the new radios. But so this big generation is on the way out, not to be morbid. And then the millennial generation is the biggest. It is bigger than them, and they're all, you know, they're all into it. So there is a lot of traction to be made. So for me, you know, historically a writer, and I still like to write, and you know, I'll do a podcast, get it transcribed, and like you with your ink column, right? You turn it into another format also. So it's a really utilitarian type content production. And I'm not just saying you should get up and spew into a microphone. You need to outline and think and construct and maybe even script in certain situations. But more or less, you've got, you know, one format of content that's working for you, and then you can turn it into articles, you can turn it into slide shares, you can turn it into speeches, ebooks, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't really talk about, you know, my podcast, sort of the behind the scenes or the numbers or all that kind of good stuff. You know, my downloads are okay, they're respectable, but what I get out of it, the way I convert you know, these conversations into blog posts, that it's, I get incredible traction. I could turn a podcast conversation, I've done this about 15 to 20 times out of my, you know, episodes from just over the past year, and most of them, and some of them just really, really take off, become truly, you know, viral, for lack of a better word. And so, you know, the content, you know, air quotes, just sort of gets out there like I just, it's unbelievable. So it's worth doing. So we're talking about some pretty exciting things. It sounds like you're all sort of psyched up about the future. Rainmaker Digital is doing well. I heard, you know, grew about 20%, and you're you know, it just seems like things are going really well. What can you tell the, you know, the writers out there who are trying to figure out, you know, how do I make, you know, some money off of this? You know, what do I do next with my writing skills? I can write, but you know, and I could set up my own WordPress site, and I've heard about this Rainmaker Digital thing, but I'm supposed to create an online course, or should I set up a SaaS business? You know, what the heck should we do?
I wouldn't start with SaaS as a writer. Trust me, it's not natural to us, but you can get there. But things like the self-published ebook market, you know, thanks to the Kindle and other reading devices. I mean, my friend Joanna Penn, she's going to speak at our digital commerce conference that's coming up this fall. And, you know, she was a writer and she was a freelancer. And then, you know, she helped other people like we tried to do. But, you know, she wrote nonfiction. She made money. She did courses. She made more money. And then she's like, you know what I really want to do? I want to write fiction. And that makes her more money than anything. And that is counterintuitive because we hear, oh, you can't make money with fiction. Well, if you're marketing savvy and you understand business because you kind of graduated to your passion instead of starting there, then you are, you know, you're the James Patterson of self-publishing, right? She has an amazingly lucrative life and career and is creatively satisfied. And there's so many opportunities for people who can create, you know, content that have writing skills, that have creativity. But you can't be afraid of saying, okay, I do have to understand how to serve a market and develop an audience based on their interest instead of mine. And it's an ego flip. I think all of us who, you know, had aspirations to write, let's face it, it was a little bit about us, wasn't it? You know, and then my best lesson that made me into an entrepreneur was like, oh, wait, I can do what I want and I can get what I want if I give people what they want. And there's a tricky intersection between what you really enjoy doing and what other people will pay money for. And as we talked about earlier, I struggled with that early on. I was kind of consumed with proving that I could make a lot of money that I ended up unhappy. But I learned the lesson in time. And then that's the interesting thing. When I said I'll never, you know, I was making between $300,000 and $500,000 a year in real estate. And that's a good living. Don't get me wrong. But I was unhappy. No amount of money is really worth being unhappy. So I walked away from it, said never again. And now I'm the CEO of a $12 million a year company. So I keep making more money by having more integrity. And I think a lot of writers think you have to sell your soul. In my experience, it's the opposite. But you do have to be savvy in the sense that people buy things for themselves. But they will choose you to do business with if you're the one that they know, like, and trust. Very simple. And they do that because you understood what they wanted and gave it to them in your own special way.
Right. So there are two elements that you just described just literally in the past few seconds, which is very interesting. One is, you know, identifying, a customer need or problem that needs to be solved. And if you could provide some sort of solution, then that's great. That's one thing. The other thing is you just mentioned is that, you know, that customer, potential customer knows, likes, and trusts you. So I think that seems to me, you know, isn't that sort of the core of, you know, why, you know, someone like me, like us, who not like yourself, you've been doing this for a long time, you've got the audience, but, you know, people who are just sort of starting out, you know, is there still white space, still opportunity for sort of the solopreneur, the individual, you know, digital entrepreneur or writer to sort of build an audience, because there's so much noise out there. There's so much content out there. And, you know, people could easily just sort of throw up their hands and say, wow, you know, why should I even try? You know, what can I actually do, you know, why jump into this ocean of content and noise? And, you know, how do I stand out from that? And should I even bother?
Yeah, well, standing out, being unique is important. And I think it's something that people struggle with, because, again, they think, oh, if I'm going to be in business, I have to be generic and not offend anyone. And it's actually the opposite. Not that I advocate offending people on purpose. You don't really have to try. On the internet, you know, you say anything with conviction and half of the people are going to be going, you're wrong. And the other people are going, you're right. And I love you. Stick with the people who love you, right? Those are your people. Who cares what the other people say? But I will say this, and this is an interesting thing because it's eternal. In 2005, if you were just starting a blog in January of 2006, like I did with Copyblogger, you were 5 years late to the party, right? And yet that was wrong. It was exactly the right time for what I was talking about. And then, you know, the content marketing thing really didn't get started till 2008. We didn't even use that term until then. And now it's a $40 billion industry. My friend Joe Paluzzi, who convinced me to call it content marketing, just sold his company for $17.9 million, you know, and he started after me. So there's that one perspective. Then it was like, well, you can't build an audience anymore. This is 2010, 2011. And then I can name you five podcasters who make over $100,000 a month who started in 2012, right? There's always the next thing. Now, I'm not saying you can't make it with a blog and a podcast. Of course you can. It really comes down to, it's not the medium necessarily. Sometimes, like if you're the king of Snapchat or whatever, you know, whatever the latest social media fad is, you can build an audience. The more important thing, I think, is what do you do with that audience? What's your relationship with them? Are they interested in doing business with you? But just as we were talking about that, it's still early in podcasting. There's a lot of content being produced, but that's not a deterrent because most of it is bad and most of it is invisible. So what you have to do is do good work and then find your way to get found. And that is tough. I will not say it isn't, but it was tough in 2006. It was tough in 1998. It was tough in 2012. And yet it happens. So don't be discouraged. Look at this as the ultimate act of creativity. That my going back to Seth Godin, you know, I forget the context. I think it was a post on Copyblogger where the question was put to many people, what is creativity? And Seth said, this might not work. And that's essentially a risk-taking proposition. If you're going to do something unique, something remarkable that is useful to people, you have to be willing to try something that might not work. And I think that's a cool answer. That's not my answer necessarily. I say creativity is finding the intersection between two seemingly unrelated things. That's what Copyblogger was. I combined blogging and copywriting. But it was exactly the right thing because you were merging content and sales.
Right. And so, I mean, you know, what would be, you know, your suggestion to the writers out there, just, you know, concretely, what could they do? I mean, besides, you know, exchanging their time for money, which a lot of us do, still do. And, you know, that's how we make our honest living. You know, would you suggest people start to think about a product being a book or an online course? And then, you know, should they just create the product and then try to think about, you know, building an audience, or try to do those in parallel, or focus on building an audience for a little while and then try to roll, you know, develop a product? You know, you've done this so successfully so many times, and you also advise people on this. You know, what's your secret sauce?
Well, it's interesting because people look at the near term and forget what happened before. So, you know, I spent 7 years building three other business. Four. One failed. And during that process, I learned a lot of what I needed to learn to do the next thing. So I didn't create a product until 2007. At that point, I'd been an entrepreneur for 9 years. And also from, you know, doing the Unemployable podcast and talking to a lot of people, there's so many similarities in people's journeys. It's like almost everyone starts out freelancing or consulting, you know, a client business. So for writers, you know, often the first, if you're in a job or something else, and usually the first step is to start working with clients. But if you're going to effectively write for clients, you're going to have to understand their business problems. And that's the best, that's a better business that, you know, an MBA has nothing on that. But too many writers are thinking that the business people are paying them for words, but they're not. The business people could care less. They just are coming to you for content because they understand somehow or another that content's supposed to solve their business problems. So it's your job to figure out, okay, what's his real drive here? What's their real problem? And again, when you start thinking that way, you start seeing opportunity everywhere. And then you start seeing gaps in markets for online courses or a different way to talk about a familiar subject, which is just called positioning. And that's what authors do. Every new book is rarely new, right? You know what I'm saying? It's an innovate, like, okay, Chip and Dan Heath. So they wrote Made to Stick. Made to Stick is essentially a marketing and copywriting book, but they never mention those words once. They give no credit to anyone in that industry. They talk about Malcolm Gladwell a lot, right? It's just positioning. They took something and they said, hey, here, we want you to know how to make ideas that stick. And that's what the advertising industry has been doing since the beginning, right? So I knew that because I had studied copywriting and direct marketing back to 1920. So when I read Made to Stick, I'm like, where's the shout out to all the ad guys you're ripping off? But, you know, that's not to rag on them or anything. I'm just saying, though, that's what authors do. They take raw information and they present it in a new and interesting way. Dan Pink, my friend, he's a great guy. He interviewed me for his book, Free Agent Nation, back in 99 when I was just starting out. And, you know, Dan, Malcolm Gladwell, they obsessively compile the work and research of others and then package it into something that someone like me would want to read, because we wouldn't read all those, you know, research studies that Gladwell pours through. Again, that's the ability to write and to synthesize information and to present it in a compelling fashion. And that's really all of this boils down to that.
I mean, I've heard you say a couple of times on podcasts that you discovered at some point that you are really an entrepreneur who can write really, really well. So I'm wondering if we could just turn attention just very, very briefly. I know we're running out of time, but just very briefly to entrepreneurs. So, you know, should entrepreneurs just go ahead and continue to hire us writers, content creators, or is there, you know, opportunity or need for entrepreneurs to develop, you know, some level of writing skill and, you know, and habit?
You know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would have said yes to the latter, but no, not anymore. I think they should hire guys and girls like that can write already. Now, if you're an entrepreneur and you love to write, which is rare, and you're just not good at it, then I think you should work at it, because that would be a great skill to have. And I recommend to all business people that they study copywriting, even if they never write a word, because that's where most businesses screw up. They talk about themselves instead of focusing on the problem or the benefit of the person who's trying to choose who to spend their money with. So I think entrepreneurs need to understand the value and the aspects behind persuasive writing. But they don't necessarily have to do it themselves and probably would be better off hiring someone who is listening in this audience right now.
amen to that. I like that. I think it's going to be very inspiring to just about everyone who's listening to this. So, Brian, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to hang out and talk about all of this, about your story. I'm now officially a subscriber and addicted to your podcast, Unemployable, and I also signed up for your newsletter further. So, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, and then also just tell us, how to find all of this.
Yeah, so Further and Unemployable are my two kind of personal projects, just stuff I want to do. Further, I just honestly do it for my own. I've been reading a lot more on personal development and fitness and all of that kind of good stuff, and yet there's so much crap out there. So Further is a newsletter that's kind of curated. It just shares what I've learned, books I've read, articles I've come across. But it's called Personal Development Without the Fluff. It's not the woo-woo stuff. It's more scientifically backed, to the extent we can even trust science, the way it's distorted in the media and whatnot sometimes. But so that's more like that, something I do for fun. Unemployable, really, it's my project, but it really serves, I think, the broader business because I'm talking to people about issues that are relevant if they were interested in using the Rainmaker platform or one of our other products. So, I really do enjoy doing the podcast, and there's a newsletter that comes with that as well. So this whole curation thing is really just, I consume a lot of stuff to make sure I'm not missing something as in my role as CEO. So why not share it with people?
Right. And that's unemployable.com.
Yes. And then, so those are Brian's personal projects. I think Unemployable would be a good source for people in this audience who are either serving clients or looking to make that next step to products and stuff like that. If you're just interested in learning more about content marketing, Copyblogger it was the first content marketing blog. It's still the largest in the world. And you can go there. We have a library of free ebooks at my.copyblogger.com. It's a free education in best practices for content marketing, landing pages, email marketing, all that. So that I would suggest checking out. And then if you are an audio person, which I'm guessing they are, they might want to check out Rainmaker FM. Unemployable is over there as well, but we've got a show called The Digital Entrepreneur for people who are looking to create products. Copyblogger FM. The Writer Files is a great podcast that Kelton of our company, Kelton Reed, he interviews everyone from New York Times best-selling fiction authors to, marketing people, anyone who writes in the context of doing something amazing. So I think
that's a good one.
Yeah, I think that's a really great show. And again, Kelton loves doing it. And I've been kind of impressed with some of the guests he's gotten over there.
No, it's good stuff. Again, Brian, thanks so much. Really, really appreciate it. It was fun.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Brian. You can find links he mentioned over on the show notes over at writewithimpact.com/episode49. And be sure to pick up some of my writing tips and jump on my e-newsletter so you're the first to know when I publish a new episode of this podcast or an article about writing, content marketing, and other topics I like to cover on Inc. and LinkedIn. Keep writing, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Write With Impact, but the learning doesn't end here. Check out our website at writewithimpact.com/gift to get your free copy of the most effective strategies to improve your writing. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.